Welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We've not got a huge amount of cricket to talk about, so we're going to focus on a few bits and pieces, some holdouts from topics we didn't manage to cover during the World Cup. But we do have Africa Division 1 to talk about, and to join me for that is my regular co-host, Andrew Nixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
Andrew, we said before Africa Division 1 that it would probably come down to the three teams that were in WCL 2, which is Namibia, Kenya and Uganda, and it did, but it probably defied expectations a little bit in how it played out. Essentially what happens when you've only got three teams that matter is that it should really come down to just three games, and the expectation I think for both of us is that Namibia would be the strongest because they've done the best most recently, but in their first match of those three against Uganda, having gone through the first couple of days where all three teams won, Namibia managed to lose to Uganda and really turned the whole tournament upside down, it seemed.
Yeah, bit of a surprising result. Namibia were looking sort of quite dominant in their earlier matches and then came up against Uganda who... You know, they'd won their previous matches, won one of the previous matches, but certainly not, sorry, two of the previous matches, but certainly not convincingly. It was a bit of a surprise result, but as we saw later, it wasn't the only surprise result of the tournament.
Yeah, Namibia were a bit weird in this match as well. I mean, one of the things that stands out for me is that Craig Williams was batting at eight, and they seem to be pushing their top order around all over the place. I mean, they've often had a really strong top order with a lot of players who could basically bat in their top five or top six, but it seems like they were experimenting in this match, and it really came back to bite them because you really don't want players of that quality way down the order. By the time he came in, the total they'd scored, which wasn't actually that bad, it was 144, but it wasn't as many as it probably should have been.
Yeah, it seems like they were taking the whole tournament as something of an experiment. So like they thought, oh, we're definitely going to go through, so we may as well just sort of experiment a bit. Obviously, as you say, Neely came back to bite them. You know, they did still manage to come through and finish in the top two.
Yeah, they did. The following day, Kenya beat Uganda, which was less of a surprise. Uganda was without Roger McArthur as well, which again makes it a little bit surprised they managed to chase 144 against Namibia because they barely made 144 in any of their 50 over matches a couple of months ago. On the final day, Kenya and Namibia playing each other. Namibia needing to win because of the net run rate, they probably were going to go through if they won, and Kenya needed to just make sure they didn't lose really badly, whereas Uganda needed to absolutely thrash Ghana. At one stage, it looked like Uganda was going to succeed in this because they were chasing only 74, and they'd managed to get the 2 for 46 off only five overs, so they were really well placed to put a bit of pressure on Kenya if they didn't chase down the total of Namibia. And then they inexplicably collapsed and lost the match by five runs, which was remarkable.
Yeah, you know, as you say, they were 46 after five overs, and then, you know, they were 60 for three in the seventh over, and then bowled out for 69. It was absolutely astonishing performance in the completely wrong way that you want it to be astonishing. And I just don't see how you can, you know, be needing nine runs in 13 overs and lose a game. It just seems impossible, but, you know, Uganda managed it.
Yeah, now, obviously, they were trying to improve their net run rate, but even, I mean, at some point, to keep that collapse going was, as I say, it was quite an astonishing thing. And it saved Kenya because in the end, they lost to Namibia by 30-odd runs. It was a fairly disappointing performance for them. And Namibia, having lost to Uganda in a previous match and looking like they might actually not make it through, they managed to turn around and end up topping the table and winning the tournament. And I might point out with Craig Williams, he batted at four against Kenya, so they did at least take that final game pretty seriously.
And he top scored with 61, so he was very much the key to winning that game. And in a very unusual tour. I think it finished pretty much as we expected, but perhaps not in the way we expected.
At the other end, I think it was a bit of a surprise as well. Botswana Ghana and Tanzania were, one of them was going to be relegated, and we would probably not have picked Tanzania. They're probably, given that they were in World Cricket League Division 5, they're probably the most well-placed of those three teams. But in the end, they really disappointed throughout the tournament, and losing on the final day to Botswana, they were the relegated team.
Yeah, Tanzania, a very disappointing performance for them in the tournament. And they were in World Cricket League Division 3 not too long ago, and they've really declined, as have Uganda to some extent. But obviously Uganda didn't do too badly in this tournament, whereas Ghana and Botswana are sort of coming on. It's something we've seen in a lot of regions, with the traditionally strong teams declining somewhat, and then the sort of next tier up coming up a little bit.
And Ghana, they had a really good tournament, I guess, because they managed to beat Uganda, which was obviously surprising, and maybe there's a bit of strangeness going on with Uganda trying to chase quickly. But for them to not get relegated was really positive for them. Unfortunately, the couple of days later, they were to play the 50-over qualifier to get back in the World Cricket League, and they didn't manage to turn it on against Botswana. They managed to lose that match pretty badly.
It bowled out for 143 in that game, and then Botswana knocked off the runs in 31.4 overs for an 8-wicket win. So a pretty dominant win for Botswana in that game. And perhaps Ghana more better suited to 2020 cricket than 50-over cricket, unfortunately for them.
Yeah, so Botswana back into World Cricket League Division 6, which I guess is good for them, and they weren't relegated from Africa Division 1, so I guess at the end they probably had the best week of any of those teams.
I'd certainly say that, and obviously they've had more experience of 50-over cricket recently because they haven't been out of the World Cricket League too long, and now they're back in it, I'm sure they'll hope to be staying there.
Interesting, of course, there's and unusually, I think, there's no cricket really at the associate level for the next 3 weeks, Andrew, because although there's quite a few tournaments coming up in May, there's a little bit of a hiatus for a bit.
So we had quite a sort of regular cycle of tournaments recently. It's very unusual to have such a lengthy break, but it gives us a break, I suppose, from doing this podcast. But it's unfortunate. We like to have lots of cricket, and unfortunately we're not getting it at the moment.
Turn then, I guess, we wanted to talk about the World Cup formats issue. We've spoken a number of times about the fact that, obviously, that we believe the associates have an important place within the World Cup because just for the benefits they derive from their exposure and sponsorship and their local thing, as well as the fact that any sort of World Cup should offer them the opportunity to compete. But the issue of format comes up, it becomes a little bit like a debate about how you should structure a political system or a constitution, and everyone has their method. What should we be aiming for, I guess, is the first question when we talk about World Cup formats. Like, what should a World Cup format attempt to achieve?
That's a very good question. Some people would say the thing that a World Cup needs to achieve is to decide which team is the best team. I would disagree with that to some extent. I think a World Cup is more about being a festival of the sport in all its varying colours, if you like, and deciding the best team is a sideshow to that to some extent. And certainly in other sports, the best team doesn't always win the World Cup. You'd hope that they do, but I don't think it's necessarily important for producing the best team. I think the aim of a World Cup is to provide an entertaining tournament.
I agree with that. I think one other thing about, when people talk about the best team, they often tend to say, well, if everyone played each other, that would provide the best team. But that's a bit false. And I mean, you can see in the Africa Division 1, for instance, why that's false. There are three teams that were likely to go through. There were two places on offer for those three. It was essentially going to come down to three games. And if there was a bit of luck in one of those games, then that would be sufficient for one of those teams to miss out. It still eventually came down to one game or two games, despite the fact that you had this large number of things, because most of the teams within the tournament were actually not able to to qualify, given that their relative difference in ability. So having every team play every other and then still going to semi-finals doesn't necessarily mean the best team's going to win. It means you might should have the best four teams in the semi-finals, but you probably won't because it's going to come down to a couple of games between the fourth, fifth, and sixth place teams about which of those goes through. And therefore, unless you're playing in the American spirit of a seven-game series or a five-game series, and that's how you determine the best team, the reality is any sort of tournament structure, there's going to be a lot of luck involved. Now, you can try and minimise it, but there's still going to be a lot of luck involved.
Yeah, and what you were saying there about everybody playing everybody, not necessarily reducing their best team, I think is exactly right, because it sometimes comes down to those just one match, and people say everybody playing everybody means every match is meaningful, and in fact it's actually the opposite. Everybody playing everybody means you're only likely to get maybe one, two, three really meaningful matches that actually decide something in the tournament.
That's right. So what we're really looking for in a tournament is decisiveness in matches. The match actually matters, and we do want to minimise the number of mismatches, because you don't want a tournament with a large number of mismatches, which we can get onto in a second. And the other thing I think we want to actually maximise is the efficiency of the tournament. We don't actually want a tournament that runs for a really, really long time. There's a certain amount of time that a tournament should run, so it has a certain weight and bulkiness to it. I don't think a straight knockout necessarily would be providing it. But you don't want a tournament such as the one we've just had that has 42 games in the group stage. I think in the tournament we've just had, the groups were too big, and the games within those groups weren't decisive enough, and also at least one or two of the teams in each group probably had almost no chance of qualifying for the quarterfinals, and a couple of teams in that group were almost guaranteed to get in the quarterfinals, because once they'd won a few games, that was all they had to do. In fact, probably three of those teams. So it wasn't a particularly interesting 6 weeks. It wasn't the worst cricket ever, but it could have been a lot better.
Yeah, I think it's going to start to, again, what makes a tournament exciting is when it's unpredictable, but you don't want it to be too unpredictable. You don't want it to be a crapshoot. You want some stability, but not too much stability. It's quite a hard dividing line to find, but I think, certainly in cricket, I think there is a dividing line where you can get a tournament that's not too unpredictable.
And that, as I say, that comes down to group size. The best thing you can do is have relatively small groups, so you don't have teams playing six games where only four of them might matter, or in the next World Cup, nine games where only four or five of them might matter, because that's terrible. So, talking about formats, what do you think is the best format for a World Cup?
I know you've had your four groups of five for a long time, and I've pretty much come round to that now, and this is four groups of five, obviously 12 teams progressing to the next stage, with your four going to direct to the quarterfinals and the other eight playing off, so the top three from each group. And the reason behind it is what I said before about it being unpredictable, not too unpredictable, because if you have four groups of four is the one that a lot of people will come up with, because that seems natural, a 16-team tournament, four groups of four, followed by quarterfinals, etc. The problem there is, although the gap is closing, there is still a drop-off in quality between 7th and 8th and 9th and 10th in terms of cricket. So in four groups of four, the teams that are fighting it out for that last spot in each group, essentially the teams ranked 5th through 8th against the teams ranked 9th through 12th, which is actually, I think that's something like Sri Lanka to Afghanistan, which is actually quite a wide gap, and it's actually quite predictable. Nine times out of ten, the teams ranked 5th through 8th, they're going to take those two spots. There's always going to be a surprise like we saw in the 2007 World Cup, but most of the time there isn't going to be. When you have four groups of five, with three from each group going through, the dividing line is essentially the teams ranked 9th through 12th against the teams ranked 13th through 16th. Which covers the range from Bangladesh to Hong Kong, and Hong Kong have beaten Bangladesh just last year. So I think any team in that group is actually capable of beating any other on any given day. So that actually makes it a little more interesting. It's a little more less predictable about which team might go through. And then, the next teams down, the teams ranked 17th through 20th, you are perhaps capable of beating those teams as well. And I think that is the ideal first round format for producing a tournament that is unpredictable, but as I say, not too unpredictable.
Yeah, I'm glad you agree with my formats. I think the other thing about the four groups of four is that it just doesn't actually produce a huge number of games either. We end up with just 24 games in that first round, that first set. And so you can extend it by having two groups of four in the next part and drawing that out, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But even then, it's not a really long tournament. And say the advantage of having the four groups of five is you get that one extra game. And as you said, I think it's very important that every single team within the tournament has something to aim for, and that's one of the issues that I have with the 2015 format, that with respect to the UAE, they probably weren't ever going to make the quarterfinals. I think at some point during that tournament, they kind of realised that the fun of just touring around and getting beaten around is not actually that great, because they'd lost their first couple of games. And you need to have that thing to aim for within that tournament. But if you do lose a couple of games, you don't want to be then hanging around, have to keep playing and losing. And so the advantage of these groups of five is they will get their four games, but if they lose two or three, that's it. They've got maybe one more game to go through. Every team in the tournament has something to aim for that second round. And so they're not going to win the tournament probably, because it'd be very difficult for any team to get through three, four knockout rounds, but they can certainly aim for something when they actually go to the tournament.
There's a other way you can do it to make it so that everybody has something to play for, by making fourth place in the group actually mean something. And whether that's automatic qualification for the next World Cup or a favourable draw in the next qualifying tournament, where the fourth place team goes directly to the final qualifying tournament and doesn't have to go through regional qualifiers or something like that. So you can actually make the fourth place in the group means something as well. So there's always something to play for. If you did that, if you have fourth place in the group meaning something, that means that no game in that first round is essentially a dead game.
What about bigger tournaments, Andrew? Or even sort of unusual tournaments? For instance, the 16-10 tournament that had two groups of eight. To me, the groups are then too big at that point, but it certainly would have been possible within the time frames of the existing tournament to have two groups of eight.
Possible, but again, you run the risk of having a lot of dead rubber games. If four teams all win their first four games, then the rest of the matches in that group are completely meaningless. They have absolutely no bearing on the tournament. That's 12 games. And if that happens in both groups, that's 24 completely dead games. So nearly half the tournament, well, a good third of the tournament is completely meaningless, and you may as well have not played it. So I think that's the problem with big groups. Any group larger than five or six, you're always going to get that. And even in six, you can get that as well. If your three teams win the first three games and you've got three going through, as in the sort of 1999 World Cup, for example. Big groups, anything larger than five is asking for trouble to some extent.
And a really big tournament? Should cricket over the long term be looking at 24 teams, 32 teams?
I think in the long term, perhaps. But I think for now, 20 teams, four groups of five is just about where would just about give a good World Cup. I think it will give a lot of matches between teams where you don't necessarily know what the result might be. That comes down to your unpredictability. And it will have mismatches, and you can't get away with that. But whatever World Cup format you can come up with, you're always going to have mismatches. And those mismatches, as we saw in this World Cup, aren't necessarily between the best team and the worst team. Sometimes they're between some of the best teams.
There was an interesting study done, and I might tweet about it, that I only came across today, but it looked at the number of mismatches in the World Cup, and it indicated that this World Cup, in fact, was more mismatched with only full members without the associate teams than it was with the associate teams. So it's a quirk of the system because that's not normally the case, but in mismatches a part of cricket, it just happens. And I think actually the rules of this tournament kind of lent themselves to more mismatches as well.
I certainly agree there, and I think it's things we've seen in the past as well. You know, at the 2011 World Cup, the only 10 wicket defeats were full members being defeated by 10 wickets, and we do see this a lot, and it's and in some extent, I don't think mismatches are necessarily a bad thing. They're always going to happen, and sometimes they happen. At quite high levels in other sports. You know, we saw in the FIFA World Cup last year, I think, was it the semi-final where one team won 7-1, or was it even the final? I can't remember. But so you do see these ridiculous mismatches even between two very strong teams and sometimes very deep into the tournament.
So to round this out, I want to touch on one other issue, and I feel it's quite common to see people, when they talk about how many teams should be at the World Cup, is to then first start with how many teams they think deserve to be at the World Cup, or how many they think are good, which is generally based on how many they've seen and have won a game ever. And I think that's really not the right way to go about thinking about a format, because what it invariably means is someone says, I think 12 is the right number because I think Ireland and Afghanistan are okay and I don't really like the teams below them. Or I think 14 is the right number because I'd like those four teams. And the reality of cricket, in fact, the reality of most sports, is the further you go down, the more closely matched teams are, and therefore the more you could start to bring teams in, even though you're expanding the mismatch between the best team and the ones below. But there's no moral imperative to say, well, 12 is better than 14, or 12 is better than 16, or 12 is better than 5 or 6, because really, when we talk about why we think associates should be in there, you can't just say, well, it's because they deserve to be, because there's no reason why we think even the 10 full members should deserve to be. What we should be aiming for, I think, is the best possible format that gives the most entertainment and a big enough tournament, looking back at those aims that we talked about at the start.
You're absolutely right. And you look at some of the other sort of formats that have been proposed. The worst was probably Martin Crowe's mammoth 18-team, 10-week World Cup. Martin Crowe, a great player, and obviously he's under a lot of stress at the moment with his health. But that was an absolutely terrible tournament. Even for those who don't know, it was two groups of nine in the first round. Everybody plays everybody. Followed by a group of 10 or something ridiculous like that, followed by best of three semi-finals and best of three finals, and it basically takes up almost a country's entire cricket seasons, which was ridiculous. But there's other formats that for all well-meaning inclusive formats, but they really don't sort of come up to scratch when you actually dig down and investigate them.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the reasons we talked about why big groups are bad ideas. Having more groups is also a good idea in this sense, because the more groups you have, the more likely it is that you can play games on the same day or on multiple days, because your groups are played on alternate days and you get rest between matches. Whereas one of the biggest issues with the 10-team World Cup is actually just because the teams need to rest between matches, it's actually going to end up longer than the 2015 World Cup, which is the 14-team World Cup, which is ridiculous, but inevitable when you have just one giant group and not actually that many games being played, where teams have to play 9 games just to get through the group stage.
Yeah, and it is possible to have teams play 2 games in 2 days, as we see at the World Cricket League, but we'd rather not have. We'd rather actually give people some time off between games, otherwise you're going to end up with people getting injured. You want to have time off, and having a large amount of groups actually allows you to give teams more time off, but still have cricket being played. And I think that's the key. You want teams to have time off, but you don't want your days when there's no cricket or no interesting cricket, whereas having four groups does allow you to do that.
All right, so we'll wrap up our World Cup format discussion for another 4 years. It's looking exceedingly like we will still have a 10-team format in 2019, although the ICC meeting is this week, so it may come up and we'll see what happened. There was some discussion from James Sutherland. He would like a shorter World Cup, but then he seemed to indicate that he thought that the 10-team World Cup would be shorter, which means he obviously has no idea what he's talking about.
So either he's an idiot or he's being willfully misleading. I think that's the only two conclusions. As anybody who thinks a 10-team World Cup will be shorter is either an idiot or being willfully misleading.
Joining us on the podcast now is the assistant editor of James Coyne and a regular on the podcast for the last couple of years to talk about the recent release of the Wisden Cricketers Almanac for 2015 and the Cricket Round the World section, which is always a highlight. Welcome, James.
Good morning, Russell. Good morning, everyone.
James, I think we'll start with the notes by the editor because it was, I think, quite an interesting part of the Wisden this year and perhaps a little bit different. I feel that in previous editors, perhaps not Lawrence, but others have tended to view development through the prism of how it will affect English cricket. And Lawrence was quite forward, I think, this year in arguing that decisions that the ECB have made that are particularly self-interested have been actually detrimental to the world game. Is that a fair comment, do you think?
I think that's a pretty fair comment. I mean, obviously, I don't want to speak completely on Lawrence's behalf, but I think he would. He's been very strong on this subject, and he's made it a central plank of the notes last year. I mean, I think it was January last year when the big three stuff sort of broke into the domain, and he sort of put that front and central in his editor's notes last year when, you know, traditionally administrative issues are not always the biggest headline grabbers because people can be pretty bored by them. But I think he realised the importance of it. And I think this year he sort of, as you say, touches on the Olympic side of things a bit more.
Yeah, and to come out and say, look, yes, it will affect the English summer, but it's much more important for the world game to say that is really good, I guess, and good to see that Wisden has taken this broader view.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, we do occasionally get accused of, I mean, the cricket is the year are still decided on the English summer, and that's sort of one of those traditions which I don't know how you can really change that. And it does mark us out from the others, I suppose, the other award ceremonies. But I suppose with the purview of the notes and of the book itself, I think has become, you know, it's not as Anglo-centric as it once was. And I think certainly in the last sort of 15, 20 years or so, the editors have tried to take a wider view. I mean, as we know, one of the big stumbling blocks of the ICC full members looking at Olympic status was the impact on the English summer. But I mean, you know, if it comes down to it, you can play younger players in an Olympic tournament, or as Lawrence says, don't. One of the options is let others play without you. You know, England don't have to take part in an Olympic tournament, and it shouldn't stop you from. It shouldn't stop you from potentially letting other teams take part. And I think the killer line is the last line of that sort of section of it where he says, even if you mock the idea of a test match in Beijing, it's a curious form of leadership that stops the dream being financed by someone else, which sort of sums up the fact that essentially the ICC seems to be turning down free money in many ways. Obviously there are a couple of caveats they don't like, but broadly speaking, this is something that the Olympic movement would do on their behalf, I think.
Yeah, I think especially for England, because they play under a Great Britain team, and therefore there's at least two other ICC members who would probably approve of being part of that team, regardless of whether England could put their first choice 11 in.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and I think... Yeah, I'm pretty sure Scotland would want to play some sort of role in that. I mean, yeah, I'd have to ask them to check that out. But I mean, it would seem pretty unusual if they didn't want to. I mean, it's the England and Wales cricket board, so that's slightly complicated. And there's been a movement to try and you may know more about this than I do, but I know there's been a movement to try and move Cricket Wales into a sort of a separate ICC member. But certainly there are other players there potentially available that could have. That we'd probably love to take part in an Olympic tournament.
the launch at the Lords had Easton Manny making his speech there, and again taking a more global view. What was his take on governance at the moment in cricket?
Well, I mean, it was quite a broad brush speech from Easton Manny. I suppose he's become known as the most vocal, probably the most vocal administrator against the Big Three move at the start of last year. To start with, he was sort of pleading the case of the smaller full members, the seven smaller full members, especially the case of West Indies. He went into quite a long study of West Indies and the finances they needed, and he argued they needed a lot more money than they were currently receiving under the new arrangement. And then he sort of touched on a little bit more on the associates and the affiliates. I wonder, I mean, he didn't really talk about them in depth. He talked about Ireland quite a lot, and he mentioned Afghanistan, and he talked about the number of matches that Ireland are currently able to play against full members, and he spoke about opportunities for Afghanistan. We know that Isan has been a big proponent of cricket in China and the USA before, and he's advocated expanding the market there a lot more than the current administration at the ICC seems to be interested in doing. He didn't really touch on that in the speech, but he did speak about Ireland specifically. I think probably because there's just been a World Cup, and you know Ireland especially are in the spotlight at the moment. But it was, you know, it was a speech that I think was pretty warmly applauded by most of the guests that were there, and I think you'd be hard pressed to find many people that would disagree with the sentiment there, I think.
I think with both Ireland and Afghanistan, the tone of discussion around them, and not just in wisdom in general, has shifted from they're something that turns up every 4 years to they're a part of the cricket community. Is that something that you've sensed as well?
Possibly. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think we've covered Irish cricket for since, I don't know, 30, 40 years, possibly longer, even though they only recently joined the ICC, relatively recently. I don't know if that's... It's an understandable accusation of the media, especially, I think, the wider media, that the media tends to view the associates when they come up against full members rather than study them in depth. And that's definitely something that is changing now. I mean, obviously we've seen the second 11 book come out recently, which is, you know, trying to give the leading associates their due a bit more. So I think that's a fair point to make. But I think in Wisden, the leading associates have always been given an annual review. They've always had a correspondent as such. So I think that's something that we've tried. We tried not to fall into that trap, but I think subconsciously, possibly the media can do that from time to time.
And you mentioned that very few people would disagree with the comments at the launch, but there was a relatively public showing of less enthusiasm from Giles Clarke, as I understand.
Yes, I suppose, Chatham House doesn't quite rule, I suppose, anymore. he was sat on the top table with among Moeen Ali and actually the editor of Wisden, Lawrence Booth, as well. And he was sat with his back to Easton Manny, who was speaking at the time, and you could sense as Manny was doing the speech that Clark was bristling slightly at some of the things that were being said. And he naturally he didn't agree with everything. But when the speech finished, he did sort of get up and start sort of gesticulating at Lawrence. So it was a pretty public thing. And he did sort of take issue with Manny as well. But I think he'd had a chat. I'm right in saying that he had a chat with Manny beforehand. So he didn't really engage him much afterwards. But I don't think Giles was particularly. particularly delighted with some of the things that Manny said, but I guess at least they feel strongly about it, I suppose.
Looking at the cricket around the world section then, it's again a mix of covering the World Cricket League and some of the important events that occurred in major associates and others. There was an excellent entry, I thought, by Julian Fountain on his time in career and trying to convert baseball players?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the... I found that one of the most enjoyable ones to sort of be involved with, really. It was not difficult to commission him. I mean, he was quite keen to write about it. And it's an, you know, it's a fascinating, you know, it's a fascinating aspect of cricket's history. You know, what cricket does in baseball playing countries, especially in the Hispanic world, where cricket seems to be really struggling now, and baseball really has taken over in many countries in Central and South America. And I think Julian Fountain has a particular interest in that. Regarding his time in Korea, I mean, you know, Korea is a pretty successful baseball playing nation with an Olympic heritage, I think. And I think that makes it quite interesting for him. I think it was a, he clearly enjoyed his time there. And he, you know, he touches on the fact that they had to adhere to an Olympic training schedule, which meant starting at 6 a.m. and finishing at 10 p.m. And as he says in his article, I politely pointed out that we were preparing for an explosive 2020 event, not a marathon. But it was sort of his point wasn't really taken on board by the authorities. But I think it's, you know, it was a fascinating event, really, the Asian Games. And then you wonder, with the reduction possibly in Asian Cricket Council tournaments coming up in the next cycle, you wonder whether the Asian Games might take on more importance for some of the associates and affiliates.
It's an interesting position for them, because obviously one of the things the Asian Games is keen on is to get the involvement of India, and it comes back to that them not being interested in the Olympic movement either, which is, so it'll be interesting to follow. Some of the others I was particularly interested in were the big nets on Montenegro and Mongolia and the Pitcairn Islands. Are they new nations for Wisden?
I think we've had Mongolia before. We've had Mongolia a few times, actually. Montenegro, this was the first cricket match in the history of Montenegro, short history, separate from Serbia. I was actually there. I didn't write this story, but I was there for this match. It was a game played on the coast near Tivat, and it was a very sort of rough and ready game, but it was probably quite an important staging post in their organisation of cricket down the Montenegrin coast, which we know is becoming more of a tourist hotspot. So hopefully there's a potential for more visiting teams to go and play there. Pitcairn Island has never been in Wisden before. There has been the odd story. I saw one in Barclays World of Cricket, which is quite an old book you may be aware of. So there is a legacy of cricket on Pitcairn Island, despite the fact that it's very isolated. And that was a fascinating story that we had by Owen Amos, who managed to get hold of a lady called Carrie Young, who sort of one of the 56 inhabitants of Pitcairn who organises cricket there. So I thought that was a really a wonderful example of one of the more isolated places around the world that plays cricket. And we try to feature one or two sort of isolated islands a year, because they do add something slightly different to the overall feel of the section. So, yeah.
And personally, the other highlights for you from this year?
Right. I quite like the Cuba entry. I managed to persuade Shil Berry, who's a former editor of Wisden, to write something for Cricket Around the World, which I was quite happy with. He sort of has form with this, really. He did a piece on Fiji about 30 years ago in Wisden before he became the editor. And he went to Cuba a lot, pretty much this time last year, I believe, on holiday. And he took some equipment with him because he'd heard from an acquaintance of his that cricket was really struggling in Cuba, and that that they were struggling for for a solid administration, that they'd been expelled from the ICC, I believe, or I think expelled rather than suspended, and that they were down to their last two teams, essentially. So that was a really wonderful story of the way that Shield, he actually batted against the two opening bowlers called Stalin and Castro, which I thought was quite a nice detail. So that's a personal favourite of mine from this year. I thought the Montenegro articles, it was a nice one, and actually the Sierra Leone articles are much more serious. It was on the impact of Ebola, and how the cricket organisation in Sierra Leone has tried to get to grips with the Ebola virus, and unfortunately they had to abandon cricket for quite a while. But the club called the Kent Cricket Club, which now has a formal link with Kent County in Canterbury, they managed to sort of lead some of the educational initiatives against Ebola in Sierra Leone. So it's not really a cricketing story as such, but it's an interesting story of how cricket can play a role in helping in times of crisis. And hopefully, we hope that maybe in Vanuatu, where it's obviously been a terrible natural disaster, hopefully cricket can play some sort of renewal role there as well, we hope.
And the articles on the leading associates, have there been changes in terms of who's been selected there?
Well, I mean, it's always a hard one to know what to do with this. I mean, we've had the rule, the editors have set the rule that a team with one day international and 2020 international status will have a full review in Wisden. So that means that Netherlands, Kenya and Canada drop out this year. We did cover Canada and cricket around the world because, as you've probably discussed on the podcast before, we had the whole Roy Singh incidents and the problem with the women's team not getting the recognition they deserve. So Canada were sort of pushed into cricket around the world this year. But we do have new sort of full-length reviews this year from Hong Kong, Nepal, Papua New Guinea and the UAE. So there's quite a big... I suppose that reflects the changing of the guard at the top level of associate cricket, really. And it's lovely to have some, you know, some new writers with some new ideas that haven't been expressed in Wisden before, and you know, especially, I mean, there's some. I found Hong Kong particularly interesting with their sort of efforts to try and promote cricket among Hong Kong Chinese people, which I don't think it's been a particularly easy process for them. But it would be fascinating to see how that pans out in the next few years. And we all know the Papua New Guinea story is a wonderful one and one of the best. I mean, personally, I believe one of the best news stories of the last few years in associate cricket, so it'll be great to see how they progress over the next few years and maybe even make it to a major tournament.
And the other section that was particularly interesting this year was the supplementary obituary section. It was, I believe, in part because of to cover cricketers who hadn't been covered who had died in the First World War, but there was a number of other interesting anecdotal attachments to cricket that were there. I particularly enjoyed the one on Henry Chadwick, the founder of baseball statistics. And interestingly, I think his use of baseball statistics, using cricket as a model, was something that took them 100 years to work around. But he was an interesting entry.
Yeah, I mean, I must confess I didn't know anything about Henry Chadwick before this was written for Wisden. And it really does show that there's a greater link there than some baseball and cricket historians seem to sort of imply, and it's fascinating really that somebody from Exeter could have crossed the Atlantic and tried to pursue cricket and then got involved in baseball really. But it was a lovely story, that one.
And there were a number of Irish internationals there, but there were a couple of other associate cricketers that you wanted to highlight that were in this section?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was, I guess there was a sort of the feelers were put out last year when it was clear that we were going to try and cover some lives that were missed. I mean, it had been done before in 1994, was in 1994, there had been another supplementary obituary section. I think we decided this year that there were more that we probably had missed. I mean, you may have read there's a lovely story on Costa Rican cricket written by a gentleman called Tim Willesey, who I believe was posted out there with the British Foreign Office. And he wrote very beautifully on Lance Binns, who's, you know, played well into his 80s. He was of Jamaican origin and lived on the Atlantic coast of Costa Rica. And there's a big Jamaican community, and that's where cricket really started from. And that was really a fascinating story of the link between the British Caribbean and Central America, and the fact that there is cricket there, and it was led by Jamaicans and Barbadians and so on. and I found that really fascinating. I mean, some wonder whether he might have played for Jamaica for first class level, but just before the war, he moved back to Costa Rica and sort of pursued farming and went into local politics and became something of a local bigwig. So that was a really wonderful story of cricket playing in Costa Rica. And another story that people who follow the podcast may be aware of was the sinking of the SS Bukhara in 1892 in the Taiwan Straits, which killed 11 of the 13 Hong Kong players who were sailing back from Shanghai. And two cricketers survived, Lieutenant Francis Markham and Dr. James Lawson, who was a doctor in Hong Kong at the time, and he actually went on to play a role in fighting against bubonic plague in Hong Kong and China, and he was a fascinating, outspoken character who invoked some quite strict rules of quarantine in the bay and in Hong Kong, and who upset the Viceroy of India when he was over there trying to fight plague as well. But he was quite sort of a well-known fast bowler, and I think he went on to captain Hong Kong in Shanghai about 6 years after the event, having even lost a lung in the shipwreck. So I felt that was a story that needed telling, really, and it was something of an oversight on Wisden's part that it hadn't been in before.
And any other highlights this year, but personally, with regard to Associate Cricket or any other of the obituaries?
Well, I think just being able to us to highlight some of these players that would have been termed associates and affiliate players that might have been lost in the ether a little bit. I mean, Wisden did not cover associate and affiliate cricket as it was then in all that much detail at all before. I would say probably before the 1990s. So really, these stories have been lost a little bit, although they have been covered elsewhere fitfully. So it was a real pleasure to sort of try and reflect that in supplementary obits this year. I do hope that, you know, if you feel as someone in the, you know, in covering associate and affiliate cricket, that Wisden is starting to is showing more of a world view and covering associates and affiliates in a more considered fashion, then I think that's, you know, that hopefully that shows we're doing something right.
Yeah, certainly. And it's fascinating. I think I mentioned last year when I was talking to you that a lot of the history of associate cricket has not necessarily been told, and that it is actually great to see these types of stories come out, and hopefully we'll see more in the future.
Absolutely, hope so. Well, I mean, we've seen with the arrival of the second 11 book, which I know you featured on your podcast, that there is people are interested in this. If it's told properly, if it's told informatively, and it's not just repeating of scorecards, which unfortunately still sort of is the way in a lot of associate and affiliate reporting, because people aren't able to attend the games. If it's told entertainingly and if it's told energetically, then people will read about it. And they are interested, and so yeah, I think hopefully there's more of a market there, and hopefully people are interested now.
Thank you, James. It's been good to have you on again, and hopefully we'll hear from you next year.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Let's move on to news, Andrew. There's a little bit of news going around. I guess with the ICC meeting this week, the most interesting news is going to be what happens to USACA. Now, in the few weeks leading up to this meeting, they finally tried to get their house in order, and they've actually done the things that they should have been doing months ago, which means they had an election, and they had the national championships. Let's start with the election. Gladstone Dainty was re-elected. That wasn't really a surprise.
I don't think this was about as much of a surprise as Kim Jong-un running the North Korean election, to some extent. Not that I'm even implying anything, obviously, although, you know, it seems to be more votes than there were leagues actually played last year, to some extent. I think this was completely unsurprising, and I think all the others went pretty much as we expected as well.
And the national championships were run, they were won. But even in this, which seemed to be a tournament that seemed to actually progress reasonably smoothly for once, there was still apparently debacle in the final, which boggles the mind. There's been no real official statement about what happened. It just seems to be people pointing fingers at each other. It's a very strange turn of events.
Although even before the final, in the semi-final, a game finished early when the floodlights were shut off, because I think USAKA had only hired the floodlights for a certain amount of time. USAKA then tried to claim it was a malfunction, but it wasn't. It's because they'd only paid for up until 9:30 p.m. or whenever it was. And then the final was unusual. It was between Southeast and a USA Development 11. And so the USA Development 11 was declared winners by four runs. By so many wickets, I can't remember the exact score. But then, after the match, they found the USA Development team was penalised 5 runs for a batsman obstructing the fielder. Now, batsman obstructing the fielder isn't a 5-run penalty; it's a wicket on appeal. So I don't know where that comes from. But that, since then, it was it was running on the pitch. The conspiracy theory here is that USA Development 11 contain players from a league that is associated with the American Cricket Federation, so therefore having that team win would have been not particularly good politically speaking. I don't put too much stock in that. I think this is a cock-up. I think there probably was 5 penalty runs, but USAKA went about announcing it in entirely the wrong way, and was very farcical, I suppose.
Which brings us to the debate that will go on the ICC. From the perspective of someone watching this and not actually involved day-to-day, I feel like what's happened in the last few weeks, particularly Glasson-Daney being re-elected, is actually the best thing that can happen for US cricket in terms of this decision, because if you've gone to the ICC and said, well, we've had a change in admin and things are going to turn around, they've got to make a decision on the new change. But the ICC is coming to this now with, this is what they've got, this is what they're going to have for the next 4 years. It's going to be the same as what they've had for the past decade and a half. If you're going to make a change, you're going to make the change, you may as well do it now, because nothing's going to change for the next 4 years.
Yes, although saying that, I don't think a decision will be taken at this April meeting. Your decisions on membership are usually taken at the annual conference, which obviously this year is in June. I think in Barbados. It was a nice gig if you can get it. And with your USA being given rights to host America's Division 1 next month, I don't see them suspending USAKA now. I think they would wait till June. The decision, it will be discussed at this meeting, but I think a decision will be deferred until June, and that will give them time to put a contingency plan in place for the team that finishes third to play in the World 2020 qualifier in July, should USA finish in that top two. So I don't think a decision will actually be taken on Monday, which was when the ICC meeting is. And even then, I don't think it would actually be expulsion from the ICC. I think it would be suspension. I think they'll be get given another year to get their house properly in order, and then it would be expulsion. So, anybody who thinks the American Cricket Federation is going to be taken over this year, I think is sadly mistaken. I think I don't think that would even be next year. I think that would probably be 2017 at the earliest. And assuming they meet the membership requirements, of course. I think this is far from over, but your Pats were in the final straight.
Yes, I think that's probably correct. I think they'll certainly come from that meeting with a clear sense of whether they are going to be suspended in June, and with the expectation that, yes, because you're already under threat from the last annual conference of that happening. And I think the ICC will also be well aware that if they do suspend them, they are utterly bankrupt and probably won't last the year. But you never really know with USAKA. They do seem to resurrect themselves somehow.
Yeah, they survived the nuclear war like cockroaches, I think, is my my usual phrase.
Somewhat sad news. It's touched, I think, everyone in the cricket world that Richie Beno passed away with an illness related to the skin cancer he got while playing without a hat for many years. It's very sad. He was a commentator who was very intelligent in the way he went about his things. I can't recall him ever saying a bad word about associates. He was the patron of French cricket, of course, and willing to put in time for players there. There's videos on YouTube where he talks to them about leg spin and other types of things. And he was someone who was always had the best interests of wider cricket at heart. He was often on the right side of history in terms of World Series cricket and things like that. He perhaps could have spent more time than he did, and particularly in his later years, getting involved in administration, but it's maybe a bit difficult to ask that much of a 78-year-old who wants to retire and spend his days in the south of France. But certainly sad to see Beno pass away.
Yeah, you're certainly, I think, probably for both of us, he was the main commentator on Test cricket when we were growing up. Certainly he was commentating on the BBC over here and then on Channel 4 before Sky Sports took the broadcasting rights over here. And I know, obviously, he did Channel 9 in Australia as well. And I think anybody who follows cricket in England and Australia, he was the voice of cricket as you were growing up. And yes, it's a tragedy, as you say. You know, he was very gracious with his time when it came to French cricket. And as you say, there's a video on YouTube of him spending time coaching Zeke Ali, the young French leg spinner, about the finer arts of leg spin. And I've seen things on Twitter recently where, you know, people would write to him asking for tips on leg spin, and he'd write back with your lengthy coaching tips and whatnot. So he was very gracious with his time, and as I say, you were never patronising about players. You didn't commentate on many associate matches, but certainly whenever I saw him commentate, he was never insulting about players. He was never patronising, and you know, he actually seemed to know about the players as well. And I think in terms of ex-players who have become ex-professional players who have become commentators, he was far and away the best of the bunch.
Yeah, and I think he loved cricket too. I think that's one of the, it seems a banal thing to say about someone who spent 70 years involved in it, but it was obvious the way he went around that he liked watching it. He liked seeing people play it. He would turn up, I think, to be the patron of French cricket, partly and mostly because he just loved seeing people play the game and enjoying the game and wanted to promote it around there, which is certainly something that is admirable, and certainly within the confines of cricket these days, it's good that he was there as someone who just loved the game rather than necessarily was there for money or fame or for some other reason.
Yeah, you know, obviously, you know, his ancestry, as his name gives away, is French, and you know, he saw it as giving back to his heritage, and it's something I think a lot of people could learn from.
Other bits of news: there was at the tail end of the World Cup some news that Australia and New Zealand, along with the ICC, were donating $400,000 to a facilities fund for East Asia Pacific cricket. That will be devoted to projects that they can apply for, where they'll give up to 50% of the money required for the project and be used for pitches and grounds and those types of things, which is good, at least in the sense that it's money to that region. But I have one issue with it that I'll get to in a minute.
Yeah, is the issue that it could be more? it's only a very small you know, amount compared to the overall income from the World Cup, and it's only, I think the document I'm reading says it's to increase the number of people regularly participating in cricket through the installation of new synthetic cricket wickets and training facilities. Well, you know, what about turf wickets and such like? So I think it's good, but it could be better, I think, is my summation of it.
Yeah, you're right, it could be more. Compared to the windfall that both those teams made with the 2015 World Cup, which was very successful, and compared to the amount of money that's coming through the new hosting right, the new broadcasting rights, and has now been directed pretty much to the big three as a result of the realignment. This is an absolute drop in the ocean. It could be 10 or 100 times more than that, and still not really hurt the ICC coffers in terms of what those two nations and particularly ICC are bringing in. So, yeah, it could be a whole lot more. 400,000 if it was a turf pitch is not going to give you a huge amount of stuff either. It's, I think I've said a number of times that the World Cricket League really should be something that is given to a hosting nation, and they should then build up facilities for that nation to host it, and rather than hosting it, nations already have facilities, and that would have left a legacy in each of those nations that hosted it. And it hasn't happened. And 400,000, great, but it's not a huge amount of money.
No, it certainly isn't.
Finally, and it may come as, I think it's a surprise to me that it hadn't happened already, but it might be worth commenting on anyway, that Nepalese former captain Binod Dass has officially retired from all cricket, although he hasn't played for Nepal since 2012.
Yeah, I thought he already had retired. obviously not. You know, he has media commitments in Nepal as well. I think he hosts a chat show, I seem to recall. So yeah, he was a good servant to Nepalese cricket over his time, but I think he probably played on a little bit too long, and obviously he's formally announced his retirement, and I think he'd still be playing club cricket in Nepal, but he's no longer available for national team selection. But he's been a good player for Nepal over the years, and he sort of was with Nepal as he started to make the way in the game to some extent, and he put in some good years for Nepalese cricket.
And that's all for this episode. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Russ, as always.